Today is Monday, November 13th, 2023. And in Yonah D'Yomer, I want to begin with a tefillah. Achainu Beit Yishkol Beit Yisrael Hanatunim Betzaru Bashiv Yom Dim Bein Biyam Vein Biyabasha Vein Ba'avia Hamokim Yerachem Aleihem V'yotziyem Mitzara L'Ravacha Me'afela L'Ora Mishibad L'Gula Hashta ba'agala u'bisman kariv v'noma amen. And I don't have to tell you, we've suffered more very dreadful losses these last few days, including quite a few men from Gush Etzion, students of Rabbi Aaron Lichtenstein, Rabbi Yehuda Amital. I hope we'll have a big hit over a tshuva when it's all over. But we have a way to go. There is a beautiful story that appeared in the Sheva this week. They interviewed one of the leaders of internal security, Chaim Ot Mazgin, and he tells his life story. He was raised Haredi, and at the age of 21, he said to his father, "I'm not doing anything in the yeshivas. I want to go into the army." His father gave him his blessing. And he went on to become, he's a major and involved with Zaka. So he tells a beautiful story here that he was on the first day working, saving Zaka. And one of the people who was left Kibbutz Be'eri, was in Yam HaMelech, I believe, already, he got in touch with him and said, "Do me a favor, go back to the kibbutz. There's a pair of tefillin that I desperately want you to save." And he went to the kibbutz. The army was there. It still was in a sanitized area, to use the word they use in Hebrew, of Mechablim was still there, but the army said, "We'll give you 5 minutes. Go in and look." He goes in and he found the tefillin. He brings them back. And the old man tells him these were tefillin that were saved from the Holocaust. And my grandson was just bar mitzvahed. He wears these tefillin. He wore the tefillin the day of his bar mitzvah. And imagine the story of the tefillin, how they have to be saved and what they've gone through. On a lighter note, I just want to tell you, I was talking with my dear Talmud, Mark Wiener. And Mark, I used the word yekes. So Mark questioned me whether hamachan Hashem lechavero, you know, chelik olam haba. So I have to show you. In my house was an interesting couple. They're both gone, unfortunately. He was Iraqi, worked for the Mossad, native Arabic Iraqi, came here at the age of 3. And his wife was from a very elegant yeki family, Bachrach. And they were members of the Association of Germans in Israel. This is their publication. And here, in their publication, Forum Tseyotzei Hayekim. This is the Forum of the Descendants of the Yekis. So I told Mark, Bizman Hazeh, you can use the word Yekis. Charlie will not be insulted. Charlie, you may be interested. There's a very fascinating article here, Professor Frankel. Pass that on. You can keep it, obviously. Okay. Now, I want to pick up where I left off. And first of all, I want to finish out. I want to not correct myself, but I listened to the shiur afterwards, and I saw, I told you a story, and I never completed it, that the problem with all the people that have left and the army is laundry. How do you do your laundry? So I praised the Nachum Lem. His wife is in charge of organizing laundry for the refugees in the Maria Hotel. And I told you a story, meaning Lini Lo Toin Yan, that my son-in-law last Friday traveled down, and he's a scholar Luftwimiluim, and he got to see one grandson of mine, one son of his, obviously, who commands a tank, Merkava 4. And then he got to the artillery base, and they did him a whole favor. They said, "We'll send out your son." Gave him 5 minutes. My grandson came out in a jeep, met his father, and my son-in-law, Chatani Kivni, I should say, my son gave him the kugel he brought, the potato kugel, Yerushalmi kugel, the soda for his whole unit there, or part of the unit, his immediate unit, and he gave my son-in-law his laundry. So again, it shows you, it ties in, that very minor things that we don't think about become so important. Now, some sad fact here. If you recall, we spoke about Rav Landau, the Rosh Yeshiva in Yachal, and I spoke about his daughter, and I asked, does anyone know what happened to his daughter? My dear student, Evelyn Baha, I searched the Yad Vashem database, and I found Genendel Golda Landau, the daughter of Rav Aryeh Landau. Prior to World War II, she lived in Klobielu, Russia, which is where they lived. He was rubbed there, and even when he was in Yachal, he would return periodically. Her father is also listed in the database, so unfortunately, that answers my question. She did not survive. Regarding my wise cracks about why Hasidim dress the way they do, it's a portable ghetto. So I have to say, Baruch Shekivanti. Regarding, this is a letter from Mike Schatz. Regarding, these are students of mine who have listened to me. I don't know if I've met them more than once, perhaps when I spoke here or there in America, but they've listened for years, maybe decades already. Regarding Hasidic garb, when I was a student at MIT, Rav Meir Horowitz, that's the Boston Rebbe's son, who's today the Boston Rebbe in Hanov, used to come to give the Gemara Shia to some of us. One of the boys asked him about Hasidic garb, and Rav Meir gave him essentially your explanation. And it's a portable ghetto. No one can justify calling a shtreimel something uniquely Jewish. But it's a portable ghetto. One of the boys, I am reminded of a picture my friend and teacher Rabbi Eliezer Finkelman had of a bunch of armed men in what we would call today distinctive Hasidic garb. Bekishes and shtreimels and horseback. It is a print of a painting of the Polish cavalry breaking the Ottoman siege of Vienna in 1683. So you see, this was, like I told you, I came out, I can never forget it. It's a moment in life, you understand, after 6 months of briefing and coming into Russia and what we went through at the airport. And here we are, standing in Moscow, on the street, 9 o'clock in the morning, Friday, daybreak is beginning, and I see all the shtreimels around me, including the women are wearing shtreimels. Now, he also mentions that Mike Schatz says, my daughter is married to Tzel Newman's younger son. Tzel Newman is married to Rav Hirschsprung's daughter. They and their children live in Israel, as does Rav Hirschsprung's daughter Carmela and her family. I think also one of his sons lives in Israel. I am sure Tzel could give you a full list. So I'm happy to hear that God saved Rabbi Hirschsprung, and I'm happy to hear that the Baruch Hashem children are here. I always get angry at Holocaust survivors who don't have descendants living in Israel. I've said to them more than once, why did God save you? To live in the five towns? To live in Hollywood, Florida? To live in Beverly Hills? Or to help build a Jewish state? What's amazing is, and I thank my dear Talmud, Rav Nachum Shmaya, who's Zion, so I it's spelled Zajak, but Yomo, how does he pronounce it?
Zion,
all right. You never met him. I wish he could be here in class and you could meet him. He's been my Talmud many decades, and I turned him into one of the outstanding Chabad historians. And remember I told you last week, we're reading Rav Pinchas Hirschsprung's memoir, and he talks about America will be the last gullus, and Reb Chaim cried, and he identifies it as Reb Chaim Brisca, and your humble servant said, I believe it was Reb Chaim Voloshin. I want you to know an entire article has appeared in the scholarly journal, the American Jewish Archives Journal. It's the November, it's 2020, numbers 1 and 2 that year. It's volume 72, 2020, numbers 1 and 2. You can get it online. Go American Jewish Archives Journal. It's a cousin of one of our students, Nachum Lamb's cousin, who does wonderful research, Zev Elif, Rabbi Dr. Zev Elif. You know him from Chicago, right? He's not there anymore, right? He's in Philadelphia.
I just read something about that. I didn't hear that.
Yeah, I think he's the head of Gretz today, if I'm not mistaken. And you won't believe it. He wrote an entirely scholarly article on the last gullus will be in America. And he quotes Reb Aaron Cutler. He says, this justified all that happened after World War II. And he quotes Reb Aaron Cutler speaking when he's organizing Lakewood. And he quotes his Rebbe, Reb Aaron Soloveitchik. My dear Rebbe colleague, I'll be boastful and say Reb Aaron Soloveitchik me a Talmud Chaver. And he quotes Reb Aaron at length on this topic. And believe it or not, right in the middle of this essay, you will find the question that I asked. I'll give you the pages. Page 96, 97, note 32. You will find the very question that I mentioned in class. He quotes Rav Pinchas Hirschsprung, and he attributes it to Reb Chaim Brisca. It's Reb Chaim Voloshin. And my Talmud, Nachum Shmayahu, went and checked the original memoir of Rav Hirschsprung in Yiddish. And the mistake is in there too. And Zev Elif has a whole footnote. It's total double talk. There's really, he made a mistake, let's face it. But I can understand that to me, I'm a Litvak. To me, Reb Chaim Voloshin, you give me some Hasidic rabbis, I'll mix them up. It's not the same to my mental framework. He pushed it. It's all a Hasidish, a Talmud from Yachal looking in. So he made a mistake. Not the end of the world. I can go into more detail on mistakes, but I'll just intimate. Now that the secret's out, that maybe my greatest achievement in life is the tapes of the Rav, which one day will be available, and maybe I'll get credit in this world. I don't know. I've done a lot of things, and it's lost, but it doesn't matter. The Ribbono Shel Olam knows. But maybe I'll get credit. They'll say, look what one dummy, a little kid from the Bronx, look what he accomplished. Thousands of tapes of the Rav saved. So I asked a member of the family who shall remain nameless, I said, why don't you let me publicize? He said, no, the Rav made mistakes. All right, we all make mistakes. In the Gemara you find two, Tanayim Amarim, but I found the Rav made two mistakes. Where did he make two mistakes? And I got that we once had in class, Rabbi Rubin will recall this, we had this in class, where the Gemara at the, I think it's Gufyav Gimel and Psachim, where you have to leave over from Kiddush the half a Havdalah. And the Rav missed twice. I heard it on tape from Maria, and Yitz heard it in Boston long before. The Rav had it, you leave over from Havdalah for Kiddush. Remember I spoke about it here 10, 20, 30 years ago, I don't remember. And Yitz said, Rabbi Reuben said, I used to drive my mother crazy when the Havdalah was finished. I put the cup with the I would take the cup remaining wine, add to it, and put it in the fridge there to have for Kiddush for Friday night. The Rebbe was just the opposite. It's not the end of the world. Then I told you there was a Medrash Rabbah with a coin in the Beit HaKfarah at Malach, and the Rebbe quoted that Medrash a number of times, but it was he quoted it backwards. And Rabbi Lichtenstein once spoke about it, that he can't exactly find the source that the Rav is quoting. It's simple. His mind, it's not a shtickle gemara was dealt with, what's dealing with halacha, with a Rambam and a Raiva. There, he never made a mistake, as far as I know. But shtickle agad, all right, you looked at it, you quickly went through it and moved on. So it doesn't take away from the godlet of Rav Hirschsprung, but I'm happy to say Aaron Rekefet is right. It's Rav Chaim Voloshin, not Rav Chaim Vriska. And go and dream. I'm so thankful to my student. Go and dream. A whole scholarly article, a good article. I enjoyed it immensely. And on that very drasha. Okay. Now I want to pick up and go further. When all is said and done about Yeshiva Chachmei Lublin, it's become a much more basic topic of scholarship in recent years. In other words, when you live through it, you go through it. When I was growing up, most parents never spoke about the Holocaust. It was an attitude of, we got to rebuild, we got to go further, we don't want to burden our children with these stories. Occasionally it leaked out. I'll tell you an interesting story. Maybe you know the player. I'll mention his name. I have a Talmud from many years ago, BMT, Dr. Phil or Shragai Kaslow. Anyone recognize the name? He lives in Teaneck. Mark knows him. Now, Charlie, you don't know that. He's a little younger than you. He's a very famous doctor, one of New York's top doctors. There's a magazine, I think it's called New Yorker, there's New York and New Yorker. It's the one that deals with New York per se. And he's always among the top 100 doctors, Columbia Presbyterian. So we were very close. We became not just my Talmud, he became like a brother. And he was, Nassim Kamenetsky, Rav Nassim used to say about him, Zay Zeltnitz, so Zeltnitz, real, rare. He came from real Litvisha stock. His parents were from Vilna, his father was from Schnippeschnuck. His father yet remembered Reb Moshe Shatzkis when he was Rabin Schnippeschnuck before Lomsha. And it's given a afraid mit Zeitzer Reidna, Litvish Yiddish. So there was a boy and a girl, and the girl gets married, the boy gets married, and we're now in his house for Shabbos, and his mother complains to me, and she would only speak English to me. You know, she was proud that she's an American and she mastered English. And if I broke into Yiddish, then min gelet Yiddish. But if not, she would speak only English. She says, Rabbi, Rabbi, my son, el hot nish kein seichel. He doesn't have any sense. He opens the refrigerator, and this is a classic story. And he says, Mom, I'm married. Your daughter's married. Why is the refrigerator filled with food? And she says to me, he doesn't understand what I went through, that I should have a refrigerator that would be empty. The memories would be terrible. It has to be stacked with food. And here in Jerusalem, a lady, an elegant lady, contributed to the Jerusalem theater. So when she died, they eulogized her. And they said about her, she never left the house without a sandwich in her pocketbook. And they said, Mrs. Sharova, you're a billionaire. Your husband left you hundreds of millions of dollars. Why do you have to take a sandwich? She said, when you go through the Holocaust, you can understand. Don't ask. Better you shouldn't understand. Okay? That's the way we grew up. Now, 100 years, 90 years later, 80 years later, so much more research is being done. I'm going to mention some sources, but one of the big questions that has come up, what happened to the library? a library of 40,000, 50,000 books, the biggest rabbinic library in all of Poland. Where did they disappear? So I have to tell you, there I have pictures on the internet. You can get pictures of everything. Here's a picture of the library. You can see all the books. Here's Rav Meir Shapiro writing, studying in the library. And what happened to it? They gave Rav Lazer Silva, he was active, I mentioned this more than once, every Torah institution benefited from him. There's a story told about the Rav. The Rav told the story when he eulogized Rav Lazer Silva's 30th at the Shloshim in 1968. I heard it with my own ears, never dreaming I'd write a definitive biography on Rav Lazer Silva. So the Rav said, there was an Aguda convention, and a number of people came from New York, immigrants, and the Rav asked who paid for the tickets. They said, Rav Lazer Silva, president of Aguda Israel in America, he paid for the tickets. And they mentioned there's a big goymel chesed. The Rav said, if you're going to count this gemilat chesed, the whole plane would be filled with people he did gemilat chesed to. So the yeshiva in Detroit, the Chachmei Lublin, he evidently was active in raising funds for them. And they gave him a gift, a certificate of thanks, and a painting that was done. And see what that painting is? The burning of the books of the yeshiva by the Nazis. That's what that painting is. Going up in flames. You can see they're throwing books into the fires. So what really happened? On the other hand, books keep on surfacing with the stamp of the Yeshivat Chachmei Lublin. I actually have a wonderful student who you all owe a debt of thanks to, Baruch Amzel, also picked me up. He's, as a result of our teachings, our classes on Monday, he established the Kvarim website where he collects information on all the Rabbanim in the United States, who's buried there. Very fascinating website. There just this morning, a Talmud, Josh Schneider from West Hempstead, sent me a link to an article on Rav Volk in the Kvarim website. So he has a book. He sent me a picture with the stamp of Yeshivat Chachmei Lublin. And there are more. I have endless pictures, scholarly articles that were done. What happened? What happened? And here you see too, it's a yeshiva Chachmei Lublin, the stamp of the yeshiva. Endless, endless pictures. What happened? So, one thing is obvious. Not everything was destroyed. And on the other hand, it's very hard to say that the story about the Nazis burning the books is not correct. This would be very, very hard to justify, because many Talmidim, the few that survived, people from Lublin that survived, they all spoke about the burning of books. I can only tell you my own conclusion, and it's not my field of scholarship. In other words, I'm very hesitant to tell you I'm right or wrong. It's if you talk with me about Rabbi Revel, Rabbi Silva, the Rav, Rabbi Belkin, all right, there, if I have an opinion, I have to be serious, and you have to take me seriously. But my own conclusion is very simple. It's half and half. The Nazis certainly burned books. But with Yeshivat Chachmei Lublin, what we do know is that they sent on books to be analyzed by experts, thinking they're very valuable. Some of them turned out to be, manuscripts turned out to be very valuable, rare printings, original printings. But they did both. And after the war, and this is the tragedy that I lived through. I lived through it with my friends, the yeshiva boys. Where were they from? After the war, everything was helter-skelter. You don't remember this. I remember as a kid, there was a Jewish program on WEVD looking for relatives. Can you remember? Looking for relatives. People came out. When I came in Aliyah to Israel, Mechapsim Mishpacha, there was a radio program once a week, a full hour, looking for relatives. Mishpachet Tarigen, I last saw this person in 39. The name of my father, the name of her father, they were brothers, we're first cousins, looking for relatives. So the same thing with books, same thing with what survived. Helter skelter here, there, everywhere. It was not organized. I don't remember when this program went off the air, but it certainly went through all of the 1970s. I still recall here in Israel. In America, I certainly recall in the 50s into the 60s that you would hear it. And there was a Yiddish radio station, WEVD, and Minzucht Mishpacha, we're looking for family, we're looking for family. And until today, you still have occasional cases where relatives discover each other 70 years after the Shoah, after the Holocaust. So this would explain certain books survived. It was helter-skelter. They certainly burned and destroyed. Now, what reached Israel, what survived and was collected by the American army, the British army, what happened was very simple, and this was explained to me by none other than my revered neighbor, Rabbi Yehoshua Hutner. He headed up the Encyclopedia Talmudica. So the rule was as follows. When books reached Israel through official channels, anything that the Hebrew University, the National Library, wanted, they got first. First pick went to the National Library. If they had copies and it was nothing unique about the volume, then it was up for grabs, either Shecheichel Shlomo or the Encyclopedia of Talmudica. Now, what you don't realize, I just said Herchel Shlomo. Yehuda Dov is looking at me, what does Herchel Shlomo have to do with the library? Well, I don't know the year it ended, but I can tell you that Herchel Shlomo had a very rich rabbinic library. Do anyone here remember it? And they had the room of Rav Herzog. You need protexia. But well, I was younger, I had protexia. I got in, I not only got in, I actually used some of the Sfarim there in response to literature. Yeah, all his Sfarim and a good deal of what survived. That library today no longer exists. I understand it's moved on. Everything has moved to Yeshurun, including the Encyclopedia Talmudica. Generally speaking, if it was a rare sefer that the Talmudica needed for research, if the Hebrew had it, then they would get it next. So that's ultimately what happened. And Svarim, here, there, and everywhere. In my office, which is a 1 minute walk from here, I'll say for myself a minute and a half, but for Mark Wiener it's a minute. Yossi, in my office, I have a Gemara printed in Shanghai. A Talmud bought it for me, a gift, a number of decades ago. You follow? No, how do I have a Gemara? Where does it say? All right, it was printed. Remember what we're talking about. This was Shanghai. This was wartime. But after the war, volumes circulated. Someone sold it. Someone put it on sale. Someone brought it to Sotheby's. And this is what I would say I believe happened with everything we're speaking about, the wonderful, wonderful library. Now, one other thought. Rev Meir Shapiro had no children. So the end of his descendants ends with him. He had a brother. The brother made it to Brooklyn. And the brother had a little shtibble in Brooklyn. Brother was famous, the kid brother of Reb Meir Shapiro. There are a number of pictures on the Kfarim site that I just mentioned. This is, again, it's a small picture, but it's the brother at a wedding. There's the Chatan in the middle, and there's Reb Moshe Feinstein on the other side. So the brother was well known. He moved in those circles. There's another picture on the Kfarim site. Here's another picture of the brother, the top picture. Here is a picture of his keva in Har HaMenuchot. Rabbi Avram Shapiro, Admor Mitalust, giving all his yichis, going all the way back to Rabbi Pinchas Mikoretz, that's Big Hasidic Yichis. And it talks about his brother, Asaz Naim Latorah Bafatzat Limut Hataf Yomi, Achiv Hamarami Lublin, and he was Seicha Lekfura. He's buried near his brother. As I told you, in the mid-50s, his brother was remains were brought to Israel and buried in Har Menuchot. I remember that vividly. I remember the Akvas Nefesh I had as a kid, not understanding Israeli mentality and Israeli society. So I remember that in the Knesset, Rabbi Menachem Parish, Havre Knesset, Agudat Yisrael, he asked all the Havre Knesset to stand in memory of the Maram Shapiro. He's being buried now at Har Menuchot, not far from the Knesset. And some of the Shoma HaTzeinics objected. Why should we stand? Who is he? What is he? Was he a Zionist, etc., etc.? And it was a member as a kid, as a B'nai Akivanik. It hurt me. It's many decades later, and that problem still challenges us. Now, I want to just mention in a lighter note, this is my Talmud. You recognize him? Anyone here recognize the rabbi who built Teaneck, Rabbi Steve Przanski? And he's giving a shiur. Where is the shiur? In Yachal Yeshiva. And he writes to me, about 35 people were in this tour group that he was leading, and all of whom can now boast they learned in Yeshiva Chachmei Lublin. All can now boast. Now, I just want to remember on a lighter level, there was another student who survived, and that was Jacob Haas. Yankala Haas, H-A-A-S. And he was a chazan. He already sang for the Maram Shapiro. You know, you're born with a good voice, you're blessed with a good voice. It's a blessing. And he sang for the Maram Shapiro. What he was famous for was he had five daughters. And he was a chazan in the Bronx. He lived at 3188 Riverdale Avenue. I believe that would be in Riverdale today, am I correct? And he was the chazan of Kingsbridge Center of Israel. I believe that may have been one of the first shuls that was, I don't know if it was exactly in Riverdale or dropped below, but he was the chazan there, and he put out many records with his five daughters singing with him. And He was a colorful graduate of Yeshiva Chachmei Lublin. I remember the records like yesterday, the five girls. It would be interesting to know who they married, where they're at today, where the grandchildren are at, where the great-grandchildren are at. This is the future. Well, wait, what did you say? Five daughters. That's what I recall. Check it out. I remember the. Do you remember the records used to show them with the daughters? Why, you think there were only, there were four? What do you think?
It might have been five, I don't know, but that, it wasn't Yankel Haas.
Jacob Haas.
No.
Here's the name from the New York Times, Jacob Haas, beloved and renowned cantor, Jacob Haas. And that's the family. All right, check it out. And I believe I'm correct, but I stand open to any correction. This is life, children, future. That's what Torah is all about. If my words,
Levesky, what? Levesky, I think, the cousin
of
the
boys. Who? Levesky.
Zalevsky?
Milevsky. No, he was also a cousin, but I'm pretty sure, I'm quite certain it was Yankel Haas who had the five daughters. And he was a Talmud of Yachal, and he yet sung for the Maram Lublin. And this is what it's all, this is continuity. And you see men, Talmidei Chachamim, who only have daughters, have a problem. Who do you talk with? Who do you raise in learning? And remember, this is what we spoke about Rabbi Landau, that his daughter was a lamdanit, the pastas fa Rosh Hashiv in Yachal. It's one thing in YU. Rabbi Soloveitchik always used to say Tova was his best student ever. That's what I quote the Rav. But in Yachal, but all right, that's the reality. You have only daughters. I have only daughters. All my daughters can learn the Daf Gemara. And I remember my wife used to say, my middle daughter was very interested in learning. And my wife used to say, don't turn her into a boy. I remember I learned brachot with her, shabbat with her. All right, I can understand. Then Vic, check it out, and let's see if I'm right or wrong. Now, among the research being done, one person, individual, who we touched upon last year, a lot has been written about him, a lot will be written. And what was unique about him, we're talking about Matisyahu Gelman. And here was a prime example of a Baal Tshuva who conquered the world. And again, I have to say that we're living in a generation, some of the best students I ever had in all the schools I taught in were Baalei Tshuva. I had students in the Kollel who were picked up by NCSY. I know the shyness they asked me about Yichus. I know the problems. These are Baal Tshuva problems. All right, I was by Ani Modela Kadosh Baruch Hu, I was able to solve every problem. I remember one was a question of conversion that his great-grandmother converted 100 years ago plus. And he was worried it wasn't a proper conversion. You have no idea what was involved because he was a Kohen, a Mitzad, his father. It's not just you can say, so do the conversion again, and et cetera, et cetera. And have them convert again. You can't do it. And what a fabulous individual. It turned out I was able to solve the problem 1,000%. But with research and the computer and contacting people, I'm in a Shemayim. There was someone here from Chicago, a Talmud of Rabbi Aaron Soloveitchik. He's divorced, went back to America. But at that time, and he's a Talmud Chacham, and he befriended me. And it turned out he came, my daughter was involved in handled the divorce, whatever, and he came from the community that this conversion took place 100 years ago, off in a place in Canada. And he gave me names of people in their 90s who would remember what's going on, who lived in Florida. When I looked at the phone number, it looked, I won't allow anyone in with a Yankee hat, I'm sorry, a disgrace to anyone who grew up in the Bronx, please. Where, well, who won there? The Diamondbacks, the Arizona was in, they lost, and the Texas Rangers, where a TR hat, Teddy Roosevelt hat, in honor of the Texas Rangers. Anyway, put it on, you can wear the Yankee hat, don't take the Rebbe so seriously. Just a sense of humor that keeps us alive. Where were we here? I got lost, 1 second. We were talking about, so today in our generation, they're endless balei tshuva. It's nothing to get excited about. But what you don't understand, many gedolim talk about it today. What a generation. When I was growing up, who heard of balei tshuva? All you saw were millions of Jews running away from Yiddishkeit. Americanized, great America. More people celebrated Thanksgiving Day than fasted on Tisha B'Av. And I absolutely think I'm correct. Today, the tshuva movement is the heart and soul of what's happened. The New York Times chokes people. The new ambassador to Israel is a Shomer Shabbos, a Ramaz graduate. The previous, a David Friedman, a Shomer Shabbos, 100%. It's interesting. He's son of a conservative rabbi. All the children from that rabbi, 100% Torah Jews. So here in Yeshivat Chachmei Lublin, there was one Baal Tshuva. And this individual captivated the people when they do their research. Matas Gelman or Matas Yahu Gelman, a lot has been written about him. I'll give you some sources in a moment, but let me just refresh your memory. I spoke about this, must be almost a year ago now. He was growing up in Vienna. Vienna, from a very early time on, in the 1800s, became a very modern city. It was like, you'll make the analogy, living in Tel Aviv today. Jerusalem's Jerusalem, Tel Aviv is Tel Aviv. People already were assimilating there, and he came from a home where his father was well-to-do, and an assimilated home, breakdown in observance. And he's a typical kid growing up. Like I was growing up in the Bronx, what happened to all the Jewish kids I knew? I don't believe anyone has a descendant who's Jewish, unless, like I mentioned yesterday, the Farkash family, Alexander's department store, Eshet Torah picked up grandchildren, and there are branches of that family living in Israel, 100% Shomer Torah mitzvah. And he chances upon an event in Vienna where the Maram Shapiro comes to raise money. And this kid hears the Maram Shapiro and it opens his heart. And he winds up going to Yachal. His parents are hysterical. What'll be with our son? You have to understand the mentality at that time. When the Rav opened up Maimonides, the Rav called the people who sent their kids to Maimonides heroes, brave people. Everyone laughed, said, you send your kid to Maimonides, he'll be a greenhorn, he won't speak English properly, you understand? What will be with him? This is America. And parents tried to bribe him back, get him back. The father promised he'd become more religious. But this kid remained in Yachal. Now, in Yachal, and we've said this and you have to understand it, while Yachal was a pan-Hasidic yeshiva, the most dominant element in Yachal was Ger. And he was attracted by the Ger Hasidim. He wound up in Ger. and he wound up a full Gera Chassid. And if you remember, Gera Chassidim, they wear knickers. Have you seen? I don't know, in Jerusalem, when I came in Aliyah, I saw it quite often. I don't know today, they may be more assimilated with the general Jerusalem Chassidim. And here I have correspondence from a dear Talmud, Rabbi Dr. Moshe Kravitz. Moshe, I assume you got your doctorate already. And he talks about his wife's grandfather who lived in Vienna and remembered all these people. And he says, I always would ask my wife's grandfather, who did you see? And he would describe them, people who came to Vienna. They came to fundraise. They came, it was in a city with you know, for tourists to come, people to rest. And that described, my wife's grandfather saw all the famous Rabbeim, Rabbi Arla from Belz, the Abad Yisrael Mivishnitz. And I asked my wife's grandfather, do you remember Matis Gelman? And he says, of course. He was the Chozer B'Tshuvah, and everyone knew the story. And he remembers him from the Chayser Zekin, that he wore the Gera pants with the white socks. No one saw anything like that in Vienna. And this kid, whenever he came back, he came back. Now, the story of he marries a daughter of a Gera Chassid, and then lo aleinu, the Holocaust comes upon us. And I want to quote to you from an article that has recently appeared. I don't know this lady, but I want to salute her. Her name is Chavi Dreyfus, spelled Dreyfuss. Chavi Dreyfus, born 1972, professor of history at the University of Tel Aviv, head of the Center for Research on the Holocaust in Poland and Yad Vashem. And she has published some fabulous articles. I don't know if she's of Anglo origins. Her English is superb. May very well be Anglo origins, English a native language. She is the lady, if you saw on October 29th, 2023, in the Jerusalem Post, comparing the unthinkable, the Black Shabbat massacre and the Holocaust. This is her article. And now I'm quoting from an article she published on the Holocaust. You'll see it quoted in her biography on Wikipedia. Gera Youth and the Holocaust, a representative blind spot in Holocaust literature. And what she's talking about, and this too has been part of the Israeli scene, and I've seen it, I've been involved with it, I spoke about it many times in my lectures when I was active in the army, Tzvah Haganah Yisrael. Over the years, I lectured to tens of thousands in the army, all over. I was all the way from the war in Beirut. I was on the Beirut-Damascus highway, all the way I was in Africa, Egypt, before we gave back Sinai. Part of that already was Africa. I remember lecturing in a frontline Air Force base, way, way, way down south. And this was a real problem. The problem is very simple. Ben-Gurion decided, when the State of Israel was declared, there's no Jewish history and no Jewish achievement from the time of Churban Bayit to the time of Hachrasat Medinat Yisrael. When it came to the Holocaust, you all know Yom HaShoah V'Hagvura is in Chodesh Nisan. And we religious Jews had a problem with it. Why Chodesh Nisan? It's when you don't say Tachnun, you shouldn't be mourning. But they insisted on making it Chodesh Nisan, Yom HaShoah V'Hagvura, the day that the Warsaw Ghetto uprising began, I believe it is. And they turned the Warsaw Ghetto, the strength, the greatness, the Zionists, what we did, what we accomplished, everybody else was like sheep going to slaughter. And this became a real problem with Israeli youth. I would say after the Yom Kippur War, it became a bit less, and certainly after what we have now, it's going to be a lot less. But what was the problem with the youth? The Israeli youth, my great-grandson already, is thinking, what's he going to do in the army? How he's going to do army? Hezda, what yeshiva? What branch of the army? Pre-army yeshiva, regular army. Every kid faces that. I remember my grandsons growing up, I always say, a kid has no teenage year. He's bar mitzvah, and after he's bar mitzvah, he's already thinking of the army. And all of you who have raised children here and grandchildren, you know what I'm talking about. This is the reality. And the 6 million Jews, who are they? Garbage, dirt. Let themselves be slaughtered like sheep. And this is a problem, but was a much bigger problem on the Israeli scene. I developed lectures that were very powerful, showing that you can't even ask this question, because we come home, we eat, we drink, we sleep, we dress, we watch TV. We live a normal life. We're humans. What Hitler did to the Jews, stage by stage, he turned them into animals looking for breadcrumbs and garbage pails for survival. And think about it. Took away their homes, put them into ghettos. People who had homes where every child had his own bed, suddenly six people are sleeping in one room. God have mercy, what that does to you. You know what it means to fast? Someone asked me if I'm fasting today. They declared, I didn't know the fast was here. I heard in America, Heschel Schachter speaking, I heard him, very nice. A fast day. So I answered, I have enough trouble fasting Tisha B'Av and Yom Kippur. I'm not going to try any new fast. As my grandson said, many grandsons said, Asaba, when you turn 80, you should get a pass. You don't have to fast anymore. But all right, I've done it already six times after turning 80. So you know what it means when you fast, but it means food. And then these people can fight? That's a fair question. I had very powerful lectures in the army. Baruch Hashem. What this lady is writing, and this was a big outcry from B'nai Brak, and I have to say Yad Vashem has attempted to ameliorate it. When you go to Yad Vashem, there's no mention of the Torah people who were Moisa Nefesh to survive as Jews. And I don't have to go any further than the story I tell in the Silver Era. I pick it up from Wiesenthal's memoir. But that story says it all. In the DP camps, Reb Lazer Silva came in. He brought no fortune of money. There was never a personality like Reb Lazer Silva. And don't dismiss him as only a personality, because the Rav revered his knowledge of Torah. I can tell you that firsthand. Here was a man, a self-made Gaon. In America, Charlie. He came to America, youngster. You know, he heard my lectures 20, 30, I don't know how many years ago. He ran away from America. You know why? He married a girl that he fell in love with, the librarian at the Strassoon Library. Everyone was yakking and talking, gossiping behind his back. Arav Zazun? Paspem? Azafroy? What yichis? What nothing? Just he picked out the girl. So he said, the heck with all of you, and he went to America. And he wanted to be an insurance salesman. His family, they took him into it. But he saw he's not going to work at it. So he found the rabbinate in Harrisburg. He learned around the clock. He became a gaon adir in America. He came on Nilui, but he became the Gaon in America. So Reb Leisa Silva brought a fortune of money. He came, remember the story, he came, Senator Taft got him an appointment to the United States Army and the ability to wear a United States Army uniform, which protected him in Poland. And in his coat was sewn in over $100,000 in American money in the coat he took out. So he gets a Sefer Torah, he's dedicating it to the DP camp, and this is the DP camp where the biggest big shot is Simon Wiesenthal. So he says to Simon Wiesenthal, well, I see you tomorrow when we're bringing in the Sefer Torah. So Wiesenthal says, no, I have nothing to do with religion. So Reb Leisa says to him, why, Favos? He says, because I remember in the concentration camps, one man had tefillin. And at night, when they finished work, people lined up and had to give him a piece of bread to put on the tefillin and say, Shema Yisrael. This is religion. And Reb Leisa says, you stupid man, why do you tell me about the cruel man who took bread to lend his tefillin? Why don't you talk about the many who lined? The many who lined up and gave away their piece of bread to put on tefillin. And Simon Wiesenthal said, from that I learned, there's always another side. And he came to the dedication of the Sefer Torah. Now, stories like that were not told. And Yad Vashem, the stories of you take Halevni Weiss, he found one sheet from a Turim, and that was the only sefer, the only sheet he had on him for all the years he was in the camps. Talking about Rav Halevi Weiss, who was later Talmud of Rav Hutner, then at JTS, and then came to America. What a fabulous individual. His own son learned in the Kollel, got smicha from YU. And Halevni Weiss, that paper, imagine time and again, he knew the paper by heart, outside, inside, inside out, but it gave him connection to Torah. Then these are stories, the Mesirat Nefesh, and in Bnei Brak, it began. There was a sefer written, I'll give you the Prager. I remember it made a big impression upon me. Elish Shalom Nichna'u. And it was many years later translated into English. And he was a survivor. He was a newspaper writer here for the Haredi newspapers. And he started that theme that there was tremendous Mesirat Nefesh by Frum Jews during the Holocaust. And Chavi Dreyfus picks it up in her writings. And in this article, Gary Youth and Holocaust, a representative blind spot, that with all the research that has been done, not enough has been done on the Jews, the great Jews, the Hasidic Jews, the Frum Jews, who refused to give in. And with all the deprivation and all the struggle and all that they went through, they did their best to keep Torah spirit in the full sense of the word. And in this article, the hero of the article is Matis Yahu Gelman. And she tells the whole story as I told it. And she speaks about Prager's book. In English it's called Those Who Never Yielded, Moshe Prager, and gone. It was first published in 1963, and it was republished many times until the demands were so great that they finally translated into English. And she says, Matis Yahu Gelman, born in 1918. Born in Vienna, he himself is worthy of an entire book. And what does she describe here? And no one but no one can get, maybe someday someone will come up with the total answer. What was amazing about him is that the Jews went underground. They wind up in the ghetto. People disappear. They remain in little rooms. They kept on learning. And Matas Yahu Gelman suddenly would appear to these hidden Gera Shtiblach and bread, food. And the most amazing thing, in full Hasidic garb. And Yossi, you don't know how moved I was yesterday. My wife and I, you must send me the picture you took with Tova, right? Tova. Your father-in-law's name was Mark, am I right? Ah, the memories you brought back. You must send that picture. Ask Yomo or Mark how to send it to me, and I'll print it out, and my wife will be very happy. Best regards to your mother-in-law. And my wife already told me stories. I wonder if your mother-in-law remembers them. All right, Baruch Hashem. Okay, let me come back here. And no one knows, how did he retain? How did you walk around? So one theory is, he spoke perfect German. Because he was born and raised in Vienna in an assimilated family, he could play the game of a Goy Gomor. But how would a Goy Gomor walk around with a beard and payas and Hasidic clothes? No one knows there the answer. And inspired by him, young Hasidim gathered into separate communes in hiding with utter dedication. They literally put their lives at risk and would not sacrifice the communal study and prayer, the performance of the commandments with utter dedication, or the continuity of the Hasidic way of life as much as they were able. And she quotes from memoir literature where someone who survived, Isaac Gutermann, describes Gelman, the most outstanding event in the life of the group, which became engraved in my memory, was the visit of Matas Gelman and his companions. He was an outstanding, influential organizer, endowed with a great deal of personal charm and a gentle, intelligent gaze. And no one can answer it. And this man went on to inspire, ultimately, the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising. Anyone who survived was sent to the death camps. And that became the end of the whole Gera Chasidus, Gelman included. This study was published by Chavi Dreyfus. It's a volume put out by Liverpool University Press, volume 33, 2021, pages 371 to 399. And I give her all the credit, continue the research, and bring to the world the light of Torah Jews, what we call today Haredim, Haredim L'dva Hashem, how Gam Ki Eilech Begeitz HaMavot Lo Irara, and at least succeeded in keeping a vestige of Torah and life under circumstances that who knows where we would be if we were faced by the same challenge. And you often know I say about the Yosef HaTzadik Mendelovich, excuse me, I call him Yosef HaTzadik. And, people wonder, Tzadik? I say, look, this guy was in jail. Never ate treif. observed Shabbat, made a Seder, worked out some sort of Hanukkah candle. We read his memoir. And where would we be if we were in jail? We'd find Heterim, Pikuach Nefesh. How many people I know, soldiers, wrote memoirs from soldiers. World War II, they ate chicken. They didn't eat meat, but they ate chicken. Treif chicken. It may be less of an Issa than meat, okay? I don't know. Basa b'chalav, of b'chalav, oli the Rabbanan, etc. Where would we be? Yosef HaTzadik. And here you talk about the Gerach HaTzadim. Elu shalo nichna'u. They didn't give in. The gates home of it. And this has to be taught to the youth. Yad Vashem, I understand, has made attempts to... My wife won't let me go back. I'd like to visit again. I was there less before some of you were born. But she says, we live in Israel. We've been through enough. We don't have to add. We lived the Holocaust. We lived the Yom Kippur War. And what we're going through now is not to be minimized. Not to be minimized at all. My grandson, I don't know if I told you yesterday, but my grandson in artillery, who's been fighting for 3 weeks already, got home for Shabbos, came to his mother, and we were all together. Shabbos came up to visit his grandmother Friday night, walked me home from shul. And the first minute is, my dear grandson, I only know him after 40 years. And I had a look at him just to be sure. He's lost, I would say, 20 pounds. He was never heavy to begin with, but wow. And his beard, wow, makes Yomo look like a reformed Jew with that beard. And Kanayin Hara. Morty, I got to tell you, they're using it back in Baltimore. Using him, wow, it's going to bring in millions. You know what I'm talking about? No. He was in Baltimore. He married a girl from Baltimore. He was in Baltimore for Sukkot. His wife and 3 children. That Shabbos, he gets a message on his phone, Tzav Shmona. Well, the next day, they're supposed to go back Monday. And United Airlines cancels. Calls Alal. Alal tells him, show up at the airport the minute the plane fills, we take off, we take the soldiers. And he was on a plane, 28 Tzav Shmona people, and a lot of American boxes filled with ammunition, filled with bombs. And he gets back on Wednesday. He left Tuesday, gets back Wednesday. Wednesday night, Thursday morning, he joins its unit. He's been with them ever since. So the kids are left in Baltimore. There's a big article about this in the Jewish Jerusalem Post this last week or this week. So the local day school took them in. And here they take in my great-grandson. I think he turned 8 in America, 7, 8. And they take in my great-granddaughter. The little one is not a year yet, so maybe a year and something. And chinam ein kesef, but they're not stupid. They're coming back now with El Al, and that too is a problem. John, you know what's going on? El Al is filled. They first of all, the planes, they took up many seats to take what America's sending. And then to get a seat that you and 3 seats together for the 4 of them with somebody. So they're coming back next week, Be'ezrat Hashem. But the school made a video, a fundraiser, of my daughter-in-law, a Baltimorean, the 2 children who, you know, were raised English at home, Hebrew on the streets, so they're bilingual, the 2 older children, and the cream on the cake, Piedras Astans, is my grandson, videoed by Yomo. You know, you do miracles today, Yomo. Take a video of me here and they'll show it tomorrow in Washington. And there he is in uniform, speaking and thanking them for taking in his children. Mori, ad kan the Hasidic world, Yeshivat Chachmei Lublin. I hope I've done justice. I am an outsider looking in, but an outsider whose heart loves all forms of Torah, Judaism, Torah existence. I hope I've done justice. Okay. Abe, we're ready to begin. Take off your beard and peyus. Gotta be clean shaven. Reb Moshe himself says, testimony, all the Litvashi yeshiva, no one was allowed to walk around with a beard. Got married, became a Rav and Ishtela, right? Then you grew a beard, until then, beardless. And here, of course, everything goes back to the Vilna Gaon, the Lashon Yeshiva. Now, when we're dealing with the early years, we have a very big problem that really the Jews, the Vilna Gaon, his era, his students, they did not have a sense of history. I quote the Rav, you can read in my work on my Rebbe, where the Rav talks about who wrote biographies, who wrote autobiographies. All that was unimportant. All that's important is our relationship with the Almighty. And that's kept quiet. The Rav would use the word Kodesh Kadashim. We didn't have revelations. You've heard Rebbe talk about it. He's written about it. We didn't have revelations. We don't have the mystical literature that you find in other religions. The Rav would give you sources, footnotes. But it was like the curtain that separated the Kodesh Kadashim from everything else. So, without autobiographies, we lack sources. In addition, we didn't have newspapers. Newspapers in the contemporary world, when you do research, it becomes invaluable. My students who picked up a love for Torah history when they were learning in Mir and Yerushalayim and tuned into my Shayurim, my lectures in Torah history, they researched newspapers. They published on the Ramah, look into Mishpacha, you'll see a number of articles by Dovi Safir and Yehudi Gebera, and they published the Maram Shapur's visit to America. They discovered this woman from Philadelphia. Philadelphia was the Ir Miklat. But there was one woman there named Miller, gave a fortune of money to Torah Gedolei Yisrael, would stay in her house. The chair that the Maram Shapiro sat on, another Gedolei Yisrael, Reb Shmuel Kamenetsky, has that chair today. You follow? But the newspapers, again, you can't take every word you read in the newspaper seriously, but that's very important. When I do research on the march in Washington, 1943, I have to look at the newspapers. All right, you have to have a scholarly sense what you can accept, what has to be verified. But I can tell you this, in the Mossad, so I was being briefed for the trips to communist Russia. So I remember I.A. Kroll, Zeichet Tzadik Levracha, you the Dove, if you don't know who I.A. Kroll is, go to our Rav Gaon, Google, type in Aryeh Kroll in Hebrew and see what you get. Miyaseid v'chaver kibbutz sad. You've heard of kibbutz sad? Right, no, you don't read the papers today? Right on the border with what used to be Gush Katif. But that's a tzioni dati kibbutz. Aryeh Kroll. That's where the Pashkana Rebbe was a member of that kibbutz before he took back his rebbeship and moved to Gilo. You follow? Aryeh Kroll. Rakefet, have you studied Washington? You're familiar with Washington?
Yeah.
You studied? Do you know it by heart? Do you understand? Do you read between the lines? Read about Aryeh Kroll there. And okay. So when they briefed me, I remember they were telling us you're going to hear various different opinions, what's going on in Russia, what the KGB wants to do. So I.A. Crow, I remember, like I'm sitting here, took his hand and said, you take what one person told you, put it here. Take what the other person told you, put it here. What corresponds, that bring back and tell us. That you can give more validity to. Where they differ, leave it aside. We can't really depend upon it. So you have to know how to handle newspapers, but they're a very important element in recreating Torah history in modern times. There were no newspapers at the time of the Gaon. You follow? So that is a problem. Then we have the other level of apocryphal stories. Books have been written. There was a volume written about the founding of Volozhin and the Reb Chaim Volozhiner, and they reproduced conversations that they claim went on 200 years ago. Well, it could be. You're almost going to write a book one day. Conversations I heard in room 425 in Gruss. You can't challenge him. He has recordings. All right. He comes up. He can record. Has the conversation. Who recorded the Vilna Gaon and Reb Chaim Volozhin speaking 200 years ago? So again, we want to be historically honest as much as we can be. We're not here to tell Hasidic tales. This is the challenge in dealing with Torah history of 200 years ago. Later, it becomes a little bit easier when I come already into the 1870s, 1880s, 1890s, it becomes easier. Elliot, why? Why? There's a lot of memoir literature. See, we've all been affected and impounded upon by the Enlightenment. Part of the Enlightenment, people write autobiographies. People write memoirs. The Haskalah crept into every yeshiva, particularly Volozhin. Volozhin had more Haskalah than any other yeshiva. Yes, World War I, to a certain degree, minimized the influence of Haskalah in the yeshiva world. And I'll tell you why. It's very simple. Haskalah gave you a feeling. It said, Kenny, wake up. Don't be narrow-minded. There's a big, beautiful world out there. There's knowledge, learning. We don't only have to have Torah. Beautiful world. Justice, social justice, concern, gemilat chasadim, Gentiles, chasidei umat olam. And then came World War I, the communist revolution, and it was a smack in the face to all thinking Jews. And you see, Kenny, if you learned in Volozhin, Slabotka, Mir, Tells before World War I, you might have kept under your pillow a book on Haskalah, modern Hebrew, love, a man, a woman, Jews, Gentiles, war and peace, Tolstoy. Wow. And then you saw what World War did. And who suffered the most? The Jew. Goyim on the way to battle took practice, killed a few Jews. The communist revolution, social justice. What came as a result? Firing squads, murder, hunger, robbery. Everything became nationalized, anything you owned. State took it away. Yeah, it's mind-boggling. And people woke up. And it's very interesting. You don't find the same problems in the Lithuanian yeshiva after World War I like you found before World War I. It's fascinating. On that level, the dream burst. The allure, the attraction. Yeshiva Bacha. Be enlightened. Join us. A new world. Be proud. Big difference. Big difference. And you can go on and on with examples. Trotsky is the best example. Here you have a Jew, his real name was Bornstein, and a big communist, right up there with Lenin, and his end, they execute him. I think it was in Mexico, where Russia goes all over to kill people until today. And Trotsky's descendants live in Kiryat Arba and Hebron today. The original name went back to Bornstein. I remember the Brit of a great-grandson. It's beyond words. But the dream burst. Now, nevertheless, we have to portray and do as honest a job as we can. What's fascinating about the Vilna Gaon is his sons wrote an introduction to his Peirush in the Shulchan Aruch. And here too, we'll come to this, but you have to know with the Vilna Gaon, we quote Sfarim he wrote, Haga'ot he wrote. Basically in his lifetime he wrote nothing. He published nothing. But what happened was, one, he kept notes on everything he learned. And later, they took his Gemara, they took his Medrash Rabbah, they took the Haggad, and Shulchan Aruch. He wrote on the side of the page, and you can imagine what a page is worth today. Haggad, Haggon, Sotheby's, $1 million minimum, probably much more. And they copied that over. The other Svarim we have from the Gaon, you have about 100 different Svarim that are attributed to the Gaon. His Talmidim kept notes. And that too became Svarim. Now, I'll tell you two cute stories about the Rav that tie in with this. One story. We had a very brilliant kid in class. My era, the Rav had, Barry Liebman always says that your era, your class, was the most brilliant class the Rav ever faced. And there are reasons why, because we were amalgamation. We were American kids like myself, who knew that Europe was gone, and if we don't know Kol HaTorah Kul, it's going to be totally forgotten. So we had that drive. Then there were survivors in the class, and they also knew that Europe was gone, and that if God privileged them to survive, they have to know Kol HaTorah Kul. We are a bright group. Part of the second group, although I think his parents reached America right before the war broke out in 39, was a kid, was my chaver, lived a block and a half, Mishaya Beilin, B-E-I-L-I-N. Shaya Beilin was a genius. He later works for AT&T, and I don't know. He never looked back. He lived somewhere, he should be alive and well, somewhere in the Boston area. He married a girl from Boston, and a girl who came to Stern College, and he married her. Remember the wedding was, that's the wedding I told you about. It was Motzoi Purim in Boston. And the Rav is Masada Kedushin, and we hear Bruchan and Kalman, Shahakol mi Yevidvaro. And we thought, what happened? Rebbe's drunk? I mean, it's not Shayach. Turned out there was no bottle of wine that wasn't open, and he was chayshish that it was already Stam Yenim, and someone who, you know, the Goyim who worked there, so he was Masada Kedushin on the schnapps. It was very matim, it was Matzoi Purim. So Shaya is in class. This is, Torah time is about 57. And Shaya's taking notes. We all took notes on sheets of paper, on a notebook. He's writing on the side of the Gemara. And the Rav looks at him and says, Beilin, was imetach? Du bist der Vilna Gaon? What's with you? You're writing on the side of the Gemara. Who are you, the Vilna Gaon? And my word of honor, Balin, without batting an eyelid, says, Efshe, Kensai. That's what he answers the Rav. But there we learned that you don't write notes on the side of your Gemara unless you're the Vilna Gaon. And that's where I first learned the first time. How did we get all these Haggot from the Gaon? How do we get all these Haggot from Shulchan Aruch? He wrote on the side. The other story with the Rav, I don't have to make these stories up, B'didi HaViyukta. We're studying with the Rav, so we'll take notes. I worked very hard. My notebooks later in life, those of you who know on Sanhedrin, they thanked me when they wrote up the notes. It's my notes are the only notes that survived on Perek Gimel. Am I right? It's Perek Gimel in Sanhedrin. So they thanked me in the introduction. What happened was I kept my notebooks, and when this fervor began to write up the Rav Sheyurim, Erwin Shapiro came to me and said, Aaron, show me your notebooks. I said, I have here 10 notebooks, thousands of pages. He says, I want to copy them. And he hired, there's a service that still exists on Rehov King George, a printing place, copied every page I ever wrote. We have it on my computer, actually, in the other room. And that went into the people who were copying in Irvin paid for it in Torah Tarav and the OU. They utilized these notes. Now, I wrote my notes. Reb Heschel Heshi Shachter wrote his notes. A third person wrote his notes. I worked very hard. I would scribble while the Rav was talking, and then I wrote them up at night. And I have to tell you, I wrote them up in Hebrew. I can show you the notebooks. I was a kid. Hebrew's not as good as it would be today when I know Hebrew much better. But I was a B'nai Akivinik. I wrote everything in Hebrew. All right. So now an exam comes. So everyone is studying with their own notes. I don't remember who it was, but there was one guy who had nice notes. Might have been in English, actually. So we decided to mimeograph his notes. And we would all study from his notes. Fine. Mimeograph was a big project. It's not like today, you Xerox, and I can print out 100 copies in a minute. The project. And one kid in the class left the notes on his desk. The Rav suddenly notices it. Was is das? Weismeyer, show it to me. Bring it over. The Rav sees it, gets hysterical. Said, Rebbe, what are you so upset? Collected it on every copy. And the Rav said, look, you take your notes. You take your notes. Yehuda, you take your notes. Anyone picks it up, they know it's your version of what you think the Rav said. But if they'll see a mimeographed version, they'll think I approved it, that this is official. Who knows how many mistakes you have in your notes? And the Rav, from that point on, we never, ever mimeographed, copied, Yahareg v'al yavor. And you see, when you hear things about the Vilna Gaon, the Chaim Voloshin, it's what students have written down. We'll never know for sure exactly what the original was. And I can tell you in my life, Baruch Hashem, 64 years of teaching Torah, I can tell you very simply. People have come over to me and they quote me, and I can swear I wasn't smart enough to say the beautiful concept they're quoting. You follow? I remember. Gevet Tosav and Achim Mocham, I spoke yesterday. Certain things I remember. But I remember meeting women, grandmothers, my students from the early 70s, Israeli Division Michlala, and they said, Rebbe, Masatasit Vishvileinu, you know, you introduced us to the world of responsive literature. These are brilliant women. And they quote, I never gave classes on that topic. But they're confusing me. Yes, I introduced them, but somewhere. But this is human nature. Today we have a miracle. Everything is recorded. All right, the recording's the recording. You hear with your own ears. But who had that? And could you imagine the Rav when they started recording Rebbe 1956. The recording, it took two people or three people to carry in the tape recorder, the reel to reel. Then when it was finished, the only person the Rav trusted with the reel was Aaron Bat, Sefer Tzadik Levracha. That's the Mark family. That's the tragedy I told you about. The price that family has paid for being Jews in the state of Israel. Why did he trust Aaron? More, you know why? Aaron was from Connecticut, New Haven. They knew each other. It was the New England, Charlie Bat, his father. M. Kenich Trayev. Him I can trust. But what? Someone else will make a copy. The Rav, this was, I write about it. This was part of Brisk. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe I'll change my mind. And the Rav, you do have periods where he said something 20 years earlier, so Machlokes with the Chazon Ish, and 20 years later, and it's right, he said like the Chazon Ish. So he said, Revi, the Chazon Ish published this Machlokes with you. He says, no. Jetzt halt es given gerecht. Today I hold he was right. So, all right, these are some of the problems you have when dealing with Voloshin, with Reb Chaim Voloshiner, with Machloiket 160, 70 years ago. But I will try my best to be as intellectually honest as I possibly can. Will I be right all the time? No. Will I be right most of the time? Be'ezrat Hashem. My dear students, what did we accomplish today? First of all, we began this year with a prayer for our Chayalim, and we're all living under tension. There's no one in this room who doesn't have friends, family, children, etc. And no one in this room who doesn't have a connection with some of the wonderful human beings who have fallen in battle. Breaks the heart. And my wife and I look at each other and say, we never thought, were you here for the Yom Kippur War, Charlie? So you know what I'm talking about. Never thought we'd have something like that again. What about you? Did you ever yourself? That was it. It can't be that bad. This time it's worse, I think, for, as I said last week, but I may be wrong. Okay, we finished out Yachal Reb Meir Shapiro. Again, I thank Evelyn. She did the research. Evelyn knows how to handle a computer and what you can find in it. And it breaks the heart. Even Rabbi Landau's daughter was killed. I feel bad that in the article written about him in Ela Eskara, why not end off about the daughter, what happened to her? The daughter is just as important as anyone else. Hashem Yikom Damam. Okay, many parents go back to the Holocaust. They've said their sons fell now. And they all make that statement that at least they fell defending Jews, not as during the Holocaust. Okay, and the issue, the library, I don't know, maybe more research will be done. But I greatly doubt if they're ever going to dig up tens of thousands of sovereign which people daydream may be hidden, may be out of sight. Matis Gelman, Eile Shelo Nichnu, those who didn't give up, they deserve a lot of credit. And he's a classic story of a Baal Tshuva who became so important and so resourceful and so helpful. And all the Baal, I hope in NCSY maybe one day they'll come out with a volume of famous Baal Tshuva and include Matis Gelman. Javi Dreyfus has a beautiful, lengthy research piece on him with a lot of information. And then we spoke about Rev. Maram Shapiro, the Maram Shapiro's brother, Brooklyn, buried Har Menuchat. And we're ready to move on. And I introduced the time of the Vilna Gaon search, the challenge. Next, we will pick up exactly where we left off with the life of the Vilna Gaon, the interrelationship with Reb Chaim Volozhin, and that great moment in time, 1802, the founding of the first yeshiva in modern times, Volozhin Yeshiva. Are there any questions from the erudite audience sitting in front of me? David, give Yomo a kick and send him up to open it up to the world. Okay. I'm signing off here till we begin in health and happiness. Das Vedanya. Yomo, let me know when I can speak.
Recording stopped.
Okay, unmute. I don't know where Jack is. I hope he's okay. Are there any questions from the erudite scholars on the screen? Rabbi Rubin, yes.
In the writings of Eliezer Berkowitz, he makes the point that you made, that how angry he is that Holocaust researchers left out the heroism of living a total life during the Holocaust. And he goes into that in real detail in his writings.
Right, so I have to tell you, if you recall my lectures many decades ago on the I spent 5 years in the Sunday class on responsa literature during the Holocaust. That would be a wonderful basis for the dignifying what from Jews, how they lived, what troubled them, the questions they asked. It is unbelievable. Mimahamakim, and then you have Rav Shimon Efrati's writings, and you have the Rav of Katamon, and you have Makatshe Hashem. It's unbelievable. All right, I hope that will be done subsequently. It's the world should be open for more and more research. And you see, someone like Javi Dreyfus, who's relatively young, born 1971, did I say? And right, 71, 72, she's 51 years old today, or when that article was written, and you see the research that lady is doing is beautiful, beautiful research. So I'm happy, Baruch Shekivanti Ledas Gedoylim, that I'm in the same camp with Rabbi Dr. Eliezer Berkowitz. Problem here is it's a new generation. Yossi, do you know who Rabbi Dr. Eliezer Berkowitz was? Yehuda Dov, do you know who he was? He lived in Chicago. How don't you know? Do you know the flying saucer in Chicago? Boy, what these guys are missing. I ought to charge them for admission to my class. I'm giving them so much knowledge and jokes. It's not jokes, it's knowledge. It happened. But anyway, to make it, what's your problem?
The flying saucer.
The plate thrown on Purim.
Oh.
Reb Chaim Zimmerman, David Applebaum. Come back here. Rabbi Dr. Eliezer Berkowitz was the Talmud Muvhak of the Sri De'esh. He got out to England in the late 30s. The Sri De'esh gave many of his manuscripts. Whenever he went into the metro, the bomb shelter, the underground in England, in London, he took nothing with him except his Rebbe's writings. And that's the basis of the Sri De'esh that was published 15 years later, approximately, by Mossad Rav Kook. It's based upon the Kitvei Yad that Rabbi Eliezer Berkowitz saved for his Rebbe during the most difficult days in London. Okay, that's a little bit about him. There's a lot more.
You know that his book, The Faith After the Holocaust, was the first book to honestly deal with the issue of how to understand the Kodesh Baruch Hu's ways during the Hallel, and he says that to believe is in the presence of doubt, that when we don't have an answer, all the answers are misleading, and that to believe in HaKadosh Baruch Hu is to understand we don't understand.
Right. What, did you hear what Rabbi Rubin just said? And so I can tell you, Yitzhak, I can tell you, Rabbi Amital tells the story in his memoir that he meets this Hungarian Jew and who he knew very well, and this Hungarian Jew says, Yuda, you remain from? What, are you crazy after what God did to us? So he says to him, well, you threw it away, right? Tell me, do you understand any better what happened by not being from? It's exactly what Rav Lazer Berkowitz is saying. See, we don't have the proper answers, but we're not going to throw away the Torah. That's our life, that's our survival, that's our tomorrow. And those are the words I told Mr. Grisman. I look back at it, the key word I told Mr. Joe Gris was, why does it trouble you that the Rav won't be here? His Talmidim will teach the Rav's thought in Torah, continuity. Underline the word continuity. Are there any more questions? Okay, Mark, are you awake? Okay, kol hakavod. Until we meet again in health and happiness, das vidanya.